You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of February, 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Nancy Durham with you over the next hour. Beautiful, booming Brazil is not so pretty at its airports, but help is on the way. The country has just awarded $14 billion in contracts to bring its three main airports into the modern age.
We are not going to have great airports, either to the World Cup or to the Olympics, but clearly the services are going to be better, and at least some kind of temporary measures probably will be done.
We'll talk with director Martin Burke about his new documentary, Under Fire, Journalists in Combat. And we'll reminisce about the Hungarian airline Malev as it goes into administration this week.
But I am both thankful and grateful because you got boys and girls like me from the great Hungarian plane to never aim for anything below 32,000 feet.
We'll also take to the roads of Port-au-Prince to hear what one of Haiti's most well-known graffiti artists thinks of the future of the country. And Jonathan Openshaw will tell us about the biggest business stories of the week, all on Midori House on M24. First, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Russia said the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad presented reform plans today to help end the bloodshed in Syria. But Western and Arab states acted to isolate Assad further as his forces resumed bombarding the protest hotbed of Homs. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov held talks with Assad in Damascus on a solution to the crisis palatable to Moscow, a longtime ally of Assad, after it vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that backed an Arab League call for his ouster. But the Russian mediation failed to slow a rush by countries that denounced the Russian-Chinese veto 3 days ago to corner Syria diplomatically and cripple Assad with sanctions in hopes of removing him and encouraging reforms to avert chaos in a region straddling major fault lines of Middle East conflict. Opposition activists said government forces renewed shelling of the central city of Homs just before Lavrov's arrival, killing some 19 people in an onslaught that they say has claimed over 300 lives in the last 5 days.
It's the first time we've ever used rocket launchers from yesterday to today. They've been using it from 5 a.m. until 7 p.m.
The Gulf Cooperation Council said its members were recalling their ambassadors from Damascus and expelling Syrian envoys from their own capitals in response to the violence. Former chief of the Arab League and Egyptian presidential hopeful Amr Moussa said it was inevitable that Assad would fall from power.
It is the history in the making in the Arab world and in the region. Change will continue to be the real driving force in the life of the Middle East and the Arab world. What is being done by the Arab League now should be supported, and I hope that the Syrian people will not suffer for long.
And Germany reiterated calls to Russia to exert pressure on the Syrian regime without any ifs and buts. In other news, President Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives, widely credited with bringing democracy to the Indian Ocean archipelago, resigned today after weeks of opposition protests erupted into a police mutiny and what an aide said amounted to a coup. Nasheed, the Sunni Muslim nation's first democratically elected president, handed power to Vice President Mohamed Wahid Hassan Manik and said that continuing in office would result in his having to use force against the people. Protests last year over the faltering economy and scrambling ahead of this year's presidential election have seen parties adopting hardline Islamist rhetoric and accusing Nasheed of being anti-Islamic. Greece's government is preparing a document with a list of painful reforms needed to clinch a new financing package, moving Athens one step closer to a deal needed to avoid a chaotic debt default. Officials worked on the draft of a text of the €130 billion bailout plan that will be put to political leaders for approval as strikers protesting against more austerity tussle with police outside Parliament. The death toll from the weekend capsizing of a boat ferrying migrants from the Dominican Republic to the neighbouring island of Puerto Rico has climbed to at least 21 and about 30 are still missing. Dominican Republic naval officials said the death toll rose after the bodies of three victims of the capsizing were plucked on Monday night from the Bay of Samana, where the rustic and overloaded vessel foundered on Saturday. And celebrations have been taking place around the world, marking the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Dickens, a titan of English literature whose vivid stories confronted the injustices of Victorian life. The British Council staged a global readathon with 24 readings from 24 Dickens texts in 24 hours, starting in Australia and taking in countries including Iraq, China and Pakistan. The actress Gillian Anderson, who recently played Miss Havisham in Great Expectations, explained his enduring appeal.
His descriptions of characters and of the state of being at that time in England was, it's part of our historical record of what it was like back then.
And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick, and happy birthday, Charles Dickens.
Absolutely.
That is a nice day to mark. I wonder what he would make of it all if we were back on the streets of London.
Imagine.
Wouldn't that be nice? Well, thank you for that. And now it's over to Thomas Schaffernacker with weather the world over.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
Here's Europe's weather. The harsh winter conditions will persist for the rest of the week. If you're travelling to the Balkans, be prepared for heavy snow. It'll be especially heavy across Serbia, Montenegro, Bulgaria. And would you believe it's even been snowing in North Africa, in Tripoli? That is very rare. You might be on business in Central and Western Europe, say Germany, France, Switzerland, Austria. Any snow that does fall Tuesday will be only light, and airports should cope. Now, unfortunately, in the coming days, the night temperatures will become extremely low again across Eastern Europe as another shot of extra cold air is on its way. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. In London, 2 degrees with sunshine. In Berlin, -4 and sunny. Moscow, -12 and cloudy. In Madrid, 5 degrees and sunny. In North America, well, it's almost as if Mother Nature has taken a break from stirring weather fronts. Very quiet, calm, tranquil in places. Virtually 90% of the US and Canada is enjoying fine weather. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. In Toronto, 0 and sunny. Washington, D.C., 5 degrees, also sunny. Chicago, 0 and sunshine. And in Dallas, 12 degrees with some blue skies. Other world centres now in the Middle East. Dubai, partly cloudy here, around 24 degrees the next few days. Chilly mornings, 10 Celsius here. South Africa, Cape Town, modest heat, 25 to 27 with a few clouds, basically very pleasant weather. And in South America, in Rio, highs of 30 degrees and dry for most of the week. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
And thank you, Thomas. It's just coming up to 8 minutes past the hour, and you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oo kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle
24. This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Who hasn't heard of Brazil's booming economy? Top models, great football, sunshine, they even have jobs. Who could ask for anything more? Well, how about an airport that works? As any jet traveler to the country will know, Brazil's airports are way out of date and can't begin to meet the increasing demand on their services. To remedy the situation, the government has just awarded $14 billion American dollars to bring its three main airports into the modern age. Raul Juste Lores is business and economics editor at Folha de São Paulo, and he's on the line from São Paulo right now. Hello.
Hello, Nancy. Hello. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to hear you. I have not had the pleasure of flying into one of your airports, so just how bad are they?
I mean, they were built, I mean, most of them in the 80s, is during our military dictatorship. So they are really outdated. And in the last 5 years, the civil aviation has grown around 20% a year. So we can say that in the last 5 years, I mean, the number of Brazilian passengers has doubled. And so many Brazilians that never flied before now are flying. And the airports belong to the era when few Brazilians could fly. So they are really outdated. There are big queues, big lines everywhere. And so there was this growing pressure to privatize the airports. But as you know, in the last 9 years, I mean, the leftist administrations of Brazil were against privatization, especially in such a strategic sector. But I do think that the World Cup and Rio Olympics deadlines somehow made the government to act faster.
Okay, well, let's pick up on that now. You've got the Football World Cup in 2014, the Olympics in 16. How on earth are you going to have an airport or three airports gussied up by then?
Yes, I do think that we are seeing just the beginning of a process. I think since it was a success, I mean, the government got these $40 billion for these three airports, that's almost 350% more than what the government was expecting. So it was, I mean, a big bet. And since Brazil probably is going to grow more in the next years, I do think that if the government starts privatizing other airports, it will get a lot of money. So I do think that we are just seeing the beginning of privatization of Brazilian airports. And of course, I mean, there are 12 cities that will host games in the World Cup. So there are still many airports to go to private hands.
12 cities in Brazil?
Yes, 12 cities are going to host games in the World Cup. And of course, I mean, these 12 airports are far from being good to stage an international event.
So these aren't. This is not going to be completed in the next couple of years. In fact, as it happens, I met Richard Rogers, the famous architect, last night, and he said that his Terminal 5 at Heathrow was sort of 20 years in negotiation and building.
It's true. I mean, even the Beijing airport, and you know that in China, you don't need to waste time with democracy and debates. They took more than 4 years to build the Terminal 3 for the Olympics in 2008. So I do think that we are not going to have great airports, either to the World Cup or to the Olympics, but definitely with the private sector leading them, clearly the services are going to be better, and at least some kind of temporary measures probably will be done. The thing is, I think these two events forced the government to privatize them, because even without World Cup, even without the Olympics, Brazilian economy badly needed better airports. So I think these two events somehow helped to defeat ideology and to put a kind of more professional approach in these airports makeover.
Great. And I understand the government is trying to have it a little bit both ways. It's sort of saying we're a little bit private, but we're also really state, and trying to keep the workers happy, but not. I understand they're not entirely happy.
It's true. I mean, actually, the Brazilian government sometimes thinks like Chinese or Russian governments, that they love these big state-owned companies, or at least to have a bigger role in economy. So, for example, the international airport in São Paulo, more than half of them is still in government hands. Not only the state-owned company Infraero still keeps 49% of the airport, and something that the private competitors in this auction complained, because they need to become partners of the government, but also the pension funds of state-owned companies got some parts of the airport. So the pension funds of some state banks are the biggest investors in this international airport of São Paulo. So although a dogma, a taboo has been broken, still the airports are in hands of the government. I mean, far way ahead than free market people would like or would expect.
Okay, I have to wrap up, but just a quickie if I can. Is it that, I mean, Brazil hasn't grown overnight. The boom has been going on for some years now. Is it that the planners just didn't think ahead and get on top of this a little bit earlier?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in 2007 and 2008, just after Brazil got the World Cup right, I mean, to host the games, some people in the government started to defend the idea of privatization of airports. But the problem is ideology was still too strong. And I do think that if the games were 10 years from now, probably this privatization wouldn't happen.
Okay.
The thing is, we were forced to privatize. So it wasn't a matter of making things done. It was about ideology. I think too much people in the government think that the government should run the airports, that the government should try to, I mean, keep this strategic sector in their hands. But reality somehow defeated this view.
We look forward to seeing the next steps. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. I've been talking with Raul Juste Lores, business and economics editor with Folha G. São Paulo. Now let's have a little music. This is Jamie Woon, and the song is Street. I'm wishing you were here with me, walking on a city street. That was Jamie Woon and Street. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be talking with producer Martin Burke about his new film on war correspondents.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Well, a new film, Under Fire, Journalists in Combat, takes us into the war zone with some of the world's most seasoned war correspondents telling their stories. The film's director and co-producer, Martin Burke, a Canadian journalist, screenwriter and novelist, joins us now by telephone from Toronto. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Look, war correspondents have had such huge attention in recent years. Films, fabulous books, the Frontline Club, which launched in London. Why did you decide to tackle this subject in such a big way right now?
Well, I have covered wars off and on over the years. I never got caught in the life of being a war correspondent or a war journalist. I saw friends of mine who did. And over the past few decades, there's been an increasing cost to covering wars. There's a psychological cost as well as the obvious occasional physical cost. It's become more dangerous in a number of ways. And a friend of mine here in Toronto, a South African psychiatrist trained in London, Dr. Anthony Feinstein, he has specialized in this field. And we started talking about it, and he approached it from a clinical point of view. I approached it from a kind of empirical point of view, and we just decided it was a natural topic for a documentary.
Excellent. Actually, I was there on the receiving end of his questions early on in his research when he was asking. I've done some of my time in the field, and like you, didn't become that, enter the cult of the war journalist, if I can put it that way, though I've seen lots of action. And we'd like to talk with Dr. Feinstein at some point, but can you tell us, working next to him, you know, what is his key conclusion as to what draws some people into the pure war correspondent role and mentality?
Well, there is this thing in the trade that people talk about becoming the adrenaline junkies. I mean, you need that kind of excitement, that lifestyle. But also some of them have said that once you've seen these incredible events, these earth-shaking, these earth-changing events, it's hard to go back to daily life. It's hard to go back to mortgage payments and the problems with the families and all this sort of thing. And that becomes your reality out there in those fields, in those terrible killing fields, not the reality back home. And some people just drift into that. And I think it's happening, it has happened more, and the cost of doing so has become more extreme in the last decade or so.
Okay, there's so much to unpack here in a short amount of time. Couple of statistics that come right off the top of your film. I understand, I haven't seen it yet, but two journalists were killed in World War I, 63 in World War II. Then you take the decade from 1996 forward to 2006, and we see nearly 1,400 dead journalists. Now, television wasn't around for World War I, but what are the reasons for this increase, risk, and these terrible numbers?
Partly the 24/7 news cycle, where in the old days, and the old days aren't that long ago, you can say 20, 30 years ago, journalists who were covering wars would be in the combat areas for a while, and then they would go back to wherever it was, whether it was London, Paris, Saigon, or wherever it was, and they would have a breather. Now there is no such thing. You're out in war all the time, and there is the pressure to get closer. There's always a horde of freelancers who have got small video cameras, who've got cameras of some kind, who will get closer than you will, and there is this pressure to go into more and more dangerous areas. And I just think that this is a documentary that probably couldn't have been done a decade ago, because most of the war journalists did not want to talk about it, and there still is a resistance in the field occasionally. There's a feeling that this is kind of touchy-feely stuff. Well, it's not at all, actually. The people who talk to us are some of the most experienced war journalists, and they have come to recognize that there are problems in that field.
I should say, I've been reading lots of reviews praising your film for having such articulate, thoughtful speakers. Talking heads, but it's almost as if you've resurrected a tired genre and, like, really brought it to life again.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that I think we caught a bit of the zeitgeist. I think out there in the general populace, there's an understanding that now, when they see a war correspondent standing up in front of a television, or when they actually read a thing in the Times of London or in the newspapers, there is a cost to doing that. The people who do that are at great risk, and you do it too long, as some of them say in the film. Which, by the way, that I heard you talk about the Frontline Club. We're at the Frontline Club tomorrow night.
Excellent.
Showing this, and that there is a cost to doing this thing too long, too often, and too recklessly. And I think the people in the profession have come to understand that.
And Martin, we just have another minute or so here. A bit of a change in track, if I can put it this way. What about the change in behavior of the warriors, the fighters in war, if I can call it that? There's an anecdote from one of the reporters in your film, I think, who talks about how you used to be able to put your window up and the confrontation would be over. Of course, now it's a bullet through the glass. Is something changed in the way people think? Well, this is too big of a question to answer in a minute, but something has changed in the behavior towards people like reporters.
Yeah, there is the idea that if the enemy kills a reporter, they will get far more press, they'll get far more publicity. So they go after the press now, rather than in the old days. If you were a reporter over in Vietnam in the 1960s and the early 1970s, you were trained to yell Bao Chi, which means press, which in theory meant they wouldn't kill you. Now, if a similar thing happened and you were in one of the combat zones, they would probably kill you first, because it would result in many more headlines. It would be perceived as much more of a victory than if they just, and I say just in quotation marks, killed a soldier.
What an awful thought to end on. But thank you very much, Martin Burke, a Canadian journalist and producer of a film you must all watch out for, Under Fire, Journalists in Combat. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's have some music now. This is Jessica Lee Mayfield and Grown Man. And thank you, Jessica Lee Mayfield, for your song, Grown Man. Coming up in the next half hour, we're going to say goodbye to the Hungarian airline, Malev. And we'll check in with Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. But first, it's time for the news headlines. And Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Nancy. Russia said the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad presented reform plans today to help end the bloodshed in Syria. But Western and Arab states acted to isolate Assad further as his forces resumed bombarding the protest hotbed of Homs. The Gulf Cooperation Council said its members were recalling their ambassadors from Damascus and expelling Syrian envoys from their own capitals in response to surging violence. President Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives, widely credited with bringing democracy to the Indian Ocean archipelago, resigned today after weeks of opposition protests erupted into a police mutiny and what an aide said amounted to a coup. Greece's government is preparing a document with a list of painful reforms needed to clinch a new financing package, moving Athens one step closer to a deal needed to avoid a chaotic debt default. The Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman met US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Washington today amid escalating security tensions between Israel and Iran and a stalled Middle East peace process. An explosion has rocked a military barracks in Nigeria's northern city of Kaduna, the latest in a string of blasts in the north of Africa's most populous nation. The death toll from the weekend capsizing of a boat ferrying migrants from the Dominican Republic to the neighbouring island of Puerto Rico has climbed to at least 21 and about 30 are still missing. And finally, celebrations have been taking place around the world marking the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Dickens, a titan of English literature whose vivid stories confronted the injustices of Victorian life. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
And you are indeed listening to Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham. And Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, has come into the studio, joins me now. And Jonathan, I learned from you that the buzzword this week is reshoring.
Well, we were unsure about reshoring, weren't we? It's one of these words that seems to have evolved a lot. It was being called inshoring, insourcing, reshoring. Okay. But essentially what it's talking about is bringing manufacturing back to the old economies, back to Europe, back to the US, from after this kind of 15 years of globalization and offshoring.
And kind of an old-fashioned word, because you think of the ships sailing around the world, doing their trading and things, and now they're sailing back after a very long time
nice
away.
Nice images, you know, on the coastline, reshoring, bringing it back home. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story for us, certainly. I mean, obviously, it's a huge political rallying cry. You hear everyone from Obama to Cameron talking about how you protect jobs and bring them home. But it's something that Monocle's followed very closely, the benefits of what you can really do by bringing quality manufacturing back closer to the companies that are using it. So, yeah, one that we're certainly watching.
Making it local again.
Exactly.
So it's happening here in the UK, it's happening in the States.
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Eastern Europe's going to be a place to watch for it as well. But the reason why I think we're talking about it this week and why it seems to be even more relevant than it's been before is that there was a big editorial in the FT about it recently. There was a big piece in Business Week. There's a kind of buzz going on. And you're seeing more and more companies, manufacturers in the US, people like there's Caterpillar, Ford, General Electric, all starting to, you know, see the benefits of how you can bring your home back.
And what's happening is the Chinese workforce, for instance, starting to get a decent wage. Is that
well? That's certainly part of it. I think looking at the statistics, it's something like Chinese wages have risen 15% a year or something over the last couple of years. So that's a huge thing. I mean, there's a company in the US which are called the Reshoring Initiative. So exactly what they do exactly what you'd say on the tin. And they've done quite extensive research into this. And essentially they've seen that when measured on price, the US is average 108% higher. So it is much higher. But then if you add all the other costs of ownership in, there's 28 additional factors and who knows what they are. But actually the US was only 12% higher. And actually in six cases of the companies they were looking at, the US ended up being lower for cost versus price than if you were manufacturing in China and then all the associated costs of shipping.
Fuel.
Exactly. Which especially more and more at the moment as well, it's not looking like these global flows are actually stable. You can't necessarily rely on them. So it's just taking it on the basis of actually cost of manufacturing, it's becoming more and more attractive.
So it makes good economic sense, but there's also this tremendous appeal to know the provenance of things, where exactly they're made, who exactly made it.
Absolutely.
Why is that so appealing to people?
Well, I think it comes from perhaps this emerging disillusionment. You know, we've seen what globalization can deliver now, and it can deliver great things. And we've seen over certainly, you know, almost two decades, the costs, or, you know, we can buy the £5 shoe and all these, you know, the benefits that have been able to bring. We're familiar with that now, but people are also starting to see what the risks are and what you lose, actually, if you lose touch with the kind of production and provenance of things. So I think people more and more, they're wanting to look beyond the logo. They're wanting to kind of scratch it off a bit, look at the provenance, look at the storytelling. And that's something that I think is definitely part of the ensuring story as well.
And a little bit of a look ahead, Central Europe, some very troubled economies there, and a bit of a hint that there's going to be inshoring. Is it reshoring?
Reshoring, insouring, insourcing.
Reshoring. They're going to shore it up and bring it home in Hungary, maybe?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I'm going to be running an interview with an interesting lady from the Espo Group, which is a company based out of Russia. But they look at they advise fashion companies particularly, but about kind of manufacturing and how to break into, you know, former Eastern Bloc economies and how you can establish there. And that's looking like a more and more attractive proposition for companies that might have at one point considered the East Asian economies, but now for various reasons, they're looking to bring things back and have a closer connection. So Eastern Europe's certainly a big place to watch over the next few years.
What about branding? There's been so much work put into branding globally, but to make things feel local. Now we'll have things be really, truly local.
Yeah, the global local.
We'll have to make it global again, even though it's local.
Well, I think this is, it's another big part of globalization as well. There's in the Entrepreneurs Show tomorrow, actually, we've got an interview with Professor John Quelch, he's the dean of the European China Business School in Shanghai. And he's talking about how, you know, you've got the three P's of marketing, which for some of them elude me now, but price and eventually finishing in place. And place is actually, we've been overlooked a lot. And you're looking at how to create kind of a global campaign without really understanding the local. So local, I think, is becoming a lot more important.
Jonathan Openshaw, thank you so much for adding the word reshoring to the lexicon and to mine, and I think to many of our listeners too.
You're welcome anytime.
Excellent. Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. And more music with Lika Lee and I Follow Rivers. That was Lika Lee from Sweden and I Follow Rivers. Coming up, a visit to Port-au-Prince and a tour of the still-recovering city with a famous Haitian graffiti artist, Jerry Rosenbert Moise.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In affairs and business, there's a bit of an oil theme. We head to Accra to find out whether Ghana can escape the oil curse that has blighted its neighbours. And we visit Santos, the Brazilian city that's using its oil profits to give Sao Paulo a run for its money.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Years on from Haiti's devastating earthquake, hundreds of thousands of people are still living in tents and other temporary accommodation. Only half of the promised aid has been delivered, and recovery programs are under threat. But the work of one graffiti artist, Jerry Rosenbert Moise, lets the people know they are not forgotten with images like these. One is a map of Haiti drawn as a face with tears running down it. Another depicts Haitians waiting in line, holding placards with "I Heart Haiti" written on them. Well, Monocle reporter Louise Williams went out one night with the graffiti artist, Jerry, to tour the nation's capital, Port-au-Prince. As they drove through the deserted, unlit streets, graffiti cans rattling in the boot of the car, they talked about his art, the country's future, and occasionally they stopped to shine the car headlights on walls featuring Jerry's work.
So where are we going now?
We're going to Pétionville, see some of my works.
So it's nighttime and we're driving through the streets and it's really quiet.
Yes, because in Haiti, once 8 o'clock, 8 or 9 o'clock, you don't have traffic and you don't have even car on the street.
So tell us about yourself.
Okay, I grew up in Port-au-Prince. I was born in Port-au-Prince, October 2nd, 1984. I went to art university, but I drop out because there are a lot of crises. I found the graffiti. It was in 2001, and then we used to go to some of the ghetto, and then I see the people living bad. So I was like, as a young artist, I should like do something to share the feelings. That's why I start to put some faces with tears all over Port-au-Prince wall.
You see Jerry's images on walls in many different parts of the city. Portraits of women with tears running down their faces. Families displaced by the earthquake portrayed holding up placards with the message, "I heart Haiti."
3 hours after the quake, by the time I was walking by and tried to check is everybody's okay, I take 2 cans of spray and start to do the Haiti map crying. La carte d'Haiti. I keep real. The Haiti map crying and with tears, the Haiti map with tears. Because my message was, we're in big trouble now. It's now time for us to have a communication with God. And that's when I start doing all those pieces. I think you see some of them. Have you seen this? A man sitting and carry a card that write, "I love Haiti."
So it's a "I heart Haiti,"
yes,
with a red heart.
"I heart Haiti."
And his, but his body language is kind of defeated.
Yes. So even though things is getting worse, so I'm like to help people to enjoy the country. Even though things are getting bad.
So what was the inspiration behind this?
So it's for giving them hope that even though your country is bad, so you have to love it. So it's like that.
And maybe there's something patient about the way the man's sitting there.
Yeah, he's waiting for something, and then, "I love Haiti, by the..." "As long as I'm sitting here, I will love Haiti. Even if I move, I will love Haiti. But I know that I'm not going to move yet, so I have to sitting and loving my country."
Got his chin in his hand.
Yes.
It's kind of a reflective pose.
Yeah.
And you sign your name on either side, on both sides?
Yes, sometimes I put twice Jerry, and sometimes I put one Jerry. But I think that I put 3 or 2 Jerrys signing down.
Oh, there's another "I love Haiti." I just saw one.
Yes.
Like somebody waiting at the bus stop. We've stopped again. Headlights on another image. Go on, describe this to us.
Yeah, this is the Haiti map crying. The half faces and then the map of Haiti.
Your style is very fluid. It's very loose.
Yes.
Very relaxed.
Yes, because before making a graffiti, you have to back and forth on the street. and to see if the cops are like looking at
time is tight. But do you know what I mean? It's like it's very, I don't know, it's very loose style.
Yeah, loose, you mean, what do you mean by...
I don't know, it just looks really relaxed. It doesn't look like it was done in a rush. It's got a nice relaxed style.
I was doing it. I don't know if by doing it quick, so I have a loose style by doing it quick, but and this one was made of four or 3 minutes.
3 or 4 minutes for that?
Yes.
Whoa.
So you'll be witness because I'm going to do something in front of you.
Just round the corner, Jerry finds the right spot for tonight and he shines his headlights on a patch of bare wall. A graffiti of a Pakistani man with a turban and a small child beside him is emerging. The child is holding back tears and the man is holding up a sign that says, "Please help." Jerry uses a brown-coloured spray paint for this portrait. It's done within 4 minutes. As he worked, another group of women were watching from the street corner. Afterwards, we took our microphone over to talk to them.
Bonsoir. You tell me.
What do you think of this graffiti, this picture?
Graffiti ça avec style ça tout.
Sad. A group of young men then came up to us. They hadn't seen Jerry at work, so they don't actually realize that this is Jerry they're talking to. So they start to brag about how they know him. He's been to their school, they say. They have it on authority that Jerry's now living in Santo Domingo. Jerry leads them along this conversation, but even he gets tired at a certain point, and so he tells them who he is.
He's run away.
That was Monocle contributor Louise Williams taking us to the streets of Port-au-Prince. Thank you. And I have another song on our list, and it is Memory Tapes. They're going to play Bicycle. And thank you. That was Memory Tapes and Bicycle. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. And next up, we have a monologue with Monocle's Tommy Serez, who has Hungary on his mind as he remembers Malév, the Hungarian airline which faces bankruptcy this week.
Funny how a brand can be such a key part of a nation's identity, and yet how the majority of its citizens don't really understand its significance until it's gone. Last week, the Hungarian flag carrier Malév ceased all operations after 66 years in business, and I am in mourning. The collapse had been years in the making, but somehow still took everyone, especially the Hungarian government, by surprise. Magyars are a weird bunch when it comes to expressing their feelings. This is my time to come clean. Malév, my dear blue-nosed friend, I apologize for having neglected you in recent years, but I want you to know that you were the only one I ever adored. The moment I stepped on your Tupolev 154 for the first time in 1997, I hoped our relationship would be a long-lasting one. You were the one thing in my life that I thought would always be there, and even when you gave me trouble, I knew we could work it out. I never thought that this day would come, even when you told me that ham was a vegetarian option or sold your landing slots at Heathrow. I may have got a bit caught up in thinking of more exotic destinations on my list, rather than the eastern connections you offered. But I am both thankful and grateful because you got boys and girls like me from the great Hungarian plain to never aim for anything below 32,000 feet. I wonder if one day someone will be able to carry our small nation's even smaller pride the way you were able to. The beginning of the end started in 2007, when the heavily indebted airline's first attempt at privatization didn't go very smoothly. Since then, even buoyant passenger numbers weren't enough to pull the airline out of its tailspin. a number of things such as bad management, unaccounted government cash, a tangled organizational structure, and a couple of other unsuccessful privatization bids contributed to Maliv's failure. Meanwhile, the European Commission's recent ruling requested the carrier to pay back 340 million euros worth of illegal state aid awarded, and the fate of Maliv was sealed. Perhaps the best way to describe the troubled organization that Maliv was is a line from the 1969 satire, The Witness, directed by Péter Bacsó, a film that was banned for more than a decade in Hungary because it criticized the communist regime. In the film, the government tries to grow oranges, but because of the climate, they turn out more like lemons. Orange, the new Hungarian orange. It's slightly yellower, slightly bitter, but our own, says the fictional Secretary of Defense. Maliv may have been a bit of lemon, but for expats like me, descending into Budapest on one of its planes was oddly good. The scent, the theme song, which is as old as me, the slightly retro uniforms and hairstyles, the warm buns, and a greeting by the kind old dears in the front of the cabin was the true feeling of home. Nations need brands that can represent them on a global scale. Airlines play a vital role in this game. It's time for Hungary, in the midst of restoring its pride and national identity, to recapture the legacy and 40% of revenues at Budapest Airport that Maliv left behind with a classy, efficient, non-low-cost alternative.
And I will say köszönöm, or thank you, to Monocle's Tommy Szerez. And Tommy, it was Maliv who taught me my few Hungarian phrases.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljati, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24. This
is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Thank you for listening to today's edition of Midori House, and my thanks to producer Marcus Hippie, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager Andrew Carter. 3 hours from now on Monocle 24, we'll have the Monocle Daily. That'll be at about 2200 London time. There you'll learn which country is thought to have the most inspiring constitution, and you'll find out why Hollywood cinema is making a comeback in Cambodia. Bonjour. I'm Nancy Durham. Headlines are next.
Hi, this is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 desu.
London, New York, Hong Kong, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
News, music and dispatches from around the world. This is Monocle 24. 24.